Welcome back. I'm Jesse Baines with Yahoo Finance Canada. You're watching Editor's Edition, and the election is done. It's a case of out with the old and in with the old. It's another Liberal minority. So what does that mean for housing? Let's get into it with Realosophy Realty's John Pasalis in Toronto. Hey, John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And in Vancouver, we have Oakland Realty's Steve Saretsky. Thanks for being here, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So we talked about some of the issues, some of the policies that the Liberals wanted to implement to bring housing affordability, to improve it. So that included building more homes, an anti-flipping tax, targeting money laundering. And we talked about the fact that, you know, building more homes is sort of more of a municipal thing. An anti-flipping tax could be good, but you know, a lot of the damage has been done, targeting money laundering, same deal. So let's get into some of the other ideas that are part of that Liberal platform, because there was quite a bit that we weren't able to get to. We wanted to give everybody equal time on our last episode, but do watch the previous one if you want a refresher about some of those other things we discussed. Okay, so the Home Buyer's Bill of Rights. So the key here, John, is ending blind bidding. That's something that's been brought up a lot. What's your view? What do you think ending blind bidding could do to the housing market?
You know, I think the big challenge is that there's a lot of debate whether the federal government can even push that forward. I mean, all the policies regarding how the bidding process works are, at the end of the day, provincial policies. And I think this is one of the things where you know, it could impact them in the next election. I mean, they made a lot of promises about things that they may not even be able to kind of put forward, like putting an end to blind bidding. I mean, I think it's a positive step forward if we can get to that point, but I don't know if the Liberals are going to be able to push the provinces to make those changes.
Out in BC, do you think that province would be on board with something like that, Steve? And do you think it would make any difference?
Yeah, no, I think it's the same thing, similar to John said. Like, we've had this conversation before, but yeah, I mean, I've spoken to, you know, the regulators here in BC that are in charge of overseeing our housing market, and there doesn't really seem to be a whole lot of desire or willpower to actually change or overhaul the existing system. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of a blurry line. I mean, I think it's the regulation of the housing markets tends to fall under the provincial level. So I don't really see how the federal government is actually going to be able to change this process and how that would look like. So to me, it feels like probably a policy that is unlikely to be implemented.
So being that I'm from Ontario, Steve, I can tell you that the sort of just the temperature here has lately been that it's the federal government's fault for our current situation about house prices being too high. I don't recall it being much of an issue in the Ontario into the Ontario election. Doug Ford didn't really address it much, I don't believe. Do you think is it different in BC where the provincial government does take a bit of a larger share of the blame, would you say, Steve?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think like the previous Liberal government took a lot of heat. You know, we had a pretty frenzied market in 2015, 2016 when they were in power. So they took a lot of the heat. But yeah, I feel like the blame, you know, from the Vancouver housing market side here, or BC for that matter, it seems to be pretty widespread. I mean, I think that everybody's kind of looking for a finger to point, you know, whether that's the Bank of Canada, it's the federal government, it's these municipalities that are, you know, choking, you know, new housing supply. So yeah, I think it's a multifaceted problem. And I feel like, you know, the general public is just trying to understand the whole problem and looking for, you know, fingers to point.
Mm-hmm. And so another one was keeping rent fair. The NDP talked about this as well. I don't recall if the Conservatives, but I definitely, the NDP did, about stopping rent evictions, this whole idea of fixing up, telling, you know, your tenant as a landlord that, you know, we need you out because, you know, my aunt's coming down, she's going to stay here, we're going to move in or whatever. And then they fix it up and then they increase the rent. And generally just keeping rental increases realistic. I know Vancouver, Steve, that they've come out with a cap on rent increases. I believe it's 1.5%. Correct me if I'm wrong. But how do you think something like this would play out in Vancouver, Steve?
The rental cap here in BC is when the Liberal government was inflation plus 2%, and then the NDP came in and scrapped that, so it's just inflation. And which is kind of ironic, because this year, I think, the latest national reading on CPI was, over 4%, and the NDP said, for this year you can raise rents, 1.5% for 2022. So the landlords, I suppose, getting the short end of that one. But it's hard. I think that you can clearly see. I think that we're because of the housing crisis, because this is a prolonged problem. I think we're going to continue to shift towards this era or this policy where governments are going to come out. They're going to continue to regulate the housing market. I think that it's continued to, the rhetoric is very anti-landlord. All the policy changes that are coming in place are pro-tenant, and I feel like that's just a secular shift that, in my opinion, is going to continue regardless of who is in power.
Right. Okay. So, John, do you think, targeting landlords is the way to go? Does this approach affect affordable rental supply? I mean, if landlords do feel targeted, then does this take affordable renting opportunities out of the market in the GTA, John?
I mean, the positive thing is we have a ton of rental supply in the pipeline that's already baked in. So I don't think it's going to have an immediate impact. I mean, it might longer term if they're, tightening up on some of these policies. But, a lot like the blind bidding, these policies they're talking about in terms of rent evictions, these are provincial policies. Like Residential Tenancy Acts is governed by the province, not the federal government. So, it's really difficult to say how much influence the feds can have over what are effectively provincial policies, and especially in provinces like Ontario, where we have a conservative government who is not as pro-tenant, is trying to be more pro-landlord, when we think about Doug Ford. So it's going to be interesting to see if they can make any movement on some of these policies they're putting forward.
I just want to pick up on a point you made about there being supply in the rentals, a lot of rental supply in the pipeline. So, I mean, a lack of supply has been cited as a reason by a lot of the boards that real estate boards that there's not enough supply, hence prices are the way they are. But then, why do rents continue to increase, John? Help us make sense of that, please.
Well, I mean, rents are increasing. I mean, I don't want to say for the same reason prices are increasing, but at the end of the day, our population's growing at a faster rate than our ability to build homes, right? And in the past 5 years under Trudeau, a lot of that population growth has been through non-permanent residents. We almost had like this shock into our economy of this rapid acceleration in population growth. A lot of students, a lot of these people need rental housing. And the fact is that up until that point, we're building, but not enough to accommodate a massive acceleration in population growth. And I think that's partly why. I mean, when we look at rents, they're definitely not appreciating at the same rate as house prices. So that it is more modest, but it's still very expensive to still rent in Toronto. And a lot of that is because, our population is growing far more rapidly than our ability to build.
Okay. So here's a pretty controversial one. There's the tax-free first home savings account. This is available only to people under 40, and 40 being 40,000 is the amount. So your money goes in tax-free, comes out tax-free. It's for the purpose of buying a home. It strikes me as a bit odd. I'll get your take, obviously, but I'll just put in my little 2 cents here. That the assumption that 40, that it's only people under 40 that are struggling to buy a home, because I know lots of people that are 40 and above who have been waiting and waiting for the market to come down and renting and just get further and further priced out. And 40,000 doesn't seem like it would go a super long way towards buying a home. But Steve, what's your take on this particular program? And I know governments love the idea of having something that's called a program. It's something that they can sort of put out there as something they've done. But anyway, Steve, what's your view on this?
Yeah, I mean, kind of curious to hear John's thoughts, but I don't really have a whole ton of clients like utilizing the existing, like I know we have that existing RSP program, right, where you can withdraw these funds, and pay them back, I think over 10 years or something like that. So
I did that. Sorry, just to interrupt you 1 second. We did that. So I am one of those people that did that, but I haven't been very mindful of repaying those funds. So hopefully at some point I can catch up and make those payments. So it's sort of maybe I'm procrastinating on that. Anyway, sorry, Steve, continue.
No, I think you're definitely one of the smarter ones here utilizing these programs. But I feel like for the most part, I feel like I don't think there's a huge uptake in that program. I don't know. I think it's going to help maybe a little bit around the margins, but I fail to see like 40K, is really going to move the needle. I think the biggest thing is really just the ability to sort of scrap and save the 40,000. And I mean, again, what are you putting that 40,000 in, right? So if you're going to save the 40K, I mean, you just throw it in like the S&P, and there's going to be some more volatility along with that. You hope for some returns, or are you throwing it in into a GIC earning less than 1%? I mean, that's not really going to help you much. So yeah, I fail to see how this program is going to meaningfully help. But again, little things around the fringes, I suppose.
Yeah, and I also wonder that the TFSA, I believe you have to be 18 to order to open one, but I wonder if younger teenagers, I mean, that would be kind of, if you think about it, if you're investing in the S&P 500 over a very long term, somebody gives you $40,000, and then at the end of 20 years, you might have a decent amount of money. So that's something I will look into and try to figure out if there's a minimum age.
Every
Sean, what's
13-year-old dreams of a pre-sale account.
That's
it's the Canadian dream.
right.
The reason I so that's one way to look at it. Sorry, kids, you're not getting any Transformers. I know kids still play Transformers for Christmas. You're going to get $100 every year to get your home buyer's incentive. Home buyer's tax-free account. Anyways, okay, let's get back on track here a little bit. And there's another, you were talked about the popularity of a program, Steve. This is one that's not been popular either, John. Now, I don't know if you've seen a lot of uptake, but the first-time buyers, home buyer's incentive, which was meant to be like a shared equity plan, but now the federal liberals say that will make it so that you can pay us back, basically pay us back when you sell the house rather than having that shared equity. Do you think that's something that's going to make this at all more attractive, more popular,
I mean,
John?
it's yeah, potentially, because it now it sounds like, I mean, and we don't have the details, but it sounds like they're going from a shared equity program to, I mean, to what? Like an interest-free loan, I guess, you know? So I mean, I think that's been one of the reasons why there has been less uptick, because no one wants to give up 5% of the equity in their home. I mean, why the heck would you when you can get a mortgage for, you know, under 2% today? Like, it's not worth it. Your home's probably appreciating at a faster rate. At least people are expecting that. So maybe this program might have a bit of an uptick, but I don't know. I don't think it's going to have a material impact on the market personally.
Can I
Yeah,
just add
so
something quickly?
yes, please.
Well, I find it interesting these savings programs and these sort of, like John mentioned, like basically these interest-free loans. To me, they're almost, like these are programs, in my opinion, that are designed to support existing valuations, right? They're not designed to, hey, let's curb demand and try to lower home prices. You can clearly see it's like, hey, no, let's try to get more people into and more people accessing the housing market. So I think it's an important signal to sort of take away. Like, giving interest-free loans to young buyers is designed to really, it's ultimately just spurs more demand.
Somebody said that the three major parties' plans were all demand plans and not supply plans. Just to answer the question, it does. I'm just looking at the platform itself, and it doesn't say anything about interest. A loan that's repayable at the time of sale is what the document says. So it does seem like an interest-free loan. Again, details hopefully to follow. Speaking of CMHC insurance, we sort of touched on this before, but the price charged on CMHC insurance would be reduced by 25%. So I'm not sure about the math on that, but whatever insurance you're going to pay, if you don't have $1 million down or 20%, I guess it is, right? Correct me if I'm getting botching any of this, but So that cost will be, what you pay upfront for that insurance will be reduced by 25%. Is that something significant, do you think, Steve?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was actually just about to Google the share price of Sagan to see if they're getting smoked there, because yeah, it's, you know, lowering CMHC's insurance premiums, you know, certainly going to eat into the private insurance business. But I don't know. Again, I fail. It's kind of like these things that kind of like just dabble around the fringes, right? Like you're making the payments, I suppose, just a tad lighter. Nothing that's really going to move the needle. But I suppose when you start adding up all these things, you know, it might help the first time home buyer sort of squeeze into the market. But like I said, at the end of the day, these are kind of more or less demand side measures that are designed to sort of help people access the housing market. So I think that ultimately translates to, you know, more demand into a housing market, assuming supply doesn't keep pace. I mean, I don't know how that's going to create longer term affordability, but pretty clear direction anyways.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting one, the mortgage, the cutoff for CMHC insurance, and you need, it's $1 million. So it has to be less than $1 million if you want to pay less than 20%. But this plan says we'll bump that up to 1.25 million. So I think that would open up opportunities for a lot more buyers in the GTA, John, given that prices, detached home prices are generally in excess of $1 million. So hence you need to come up with that 20%, making it that much more difficult. What's your view on this idea?
Oh, I mean, I don't want to say it's a bad idea, but again, it's like it's a demand side policy that's going to fuel more demand and more debt, push house prices higher. And out of all these policies, I mean, I think this is the one that could have the biggest like immediate impact on consumer behavior, because you got to think about it. I mean, if your home buying budget today is $999 because you only have five or seven or 10% down payment, but your income's strong enough to support more, are those buyers going to wait to see, okay, are they going to increase the premium so that they can spend a little bit more? Are home sellers going to hold off who are right in that price bracket that would be impacted by it, hold off listing? And I think this is probably like most federal policy people don't care about, they're long term, but this is kind of the one that could have a huge impact on both sellers and buyers. And the uncertainty about when that might come out might influence people's behaviors in the short term, I think. So I think that's going to be one interesting one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and I was just, we were just chatting earlier, but I just imagine somebody who's got their heart set on that house that just happens to be at 1.25 million today. By the time this gets implemented, we're about 1.35 and it doesn't matter anymore. Steve, you were going to say something.
I think that's a big policy. I mean, I see it here all the time in Vancouver where I've seen many of the cases. I can think of a couple of clients right now, just at the top of my head, that are directly impacted by a 999 buffer. Whether that's their cap budget or it's a seller that says, "Hey, I need to get this home under 1 million strategically because I open up my buyer pool significantly." And so, yeah, if you bump that to 1.25, it's like it. To me, it basically raises the sort of benchmark, so to speak. Like you just open up that buyer pool. So again, I mean, not to keep, you know, beating the same drum here, but kind of a demand side measure. And I think John's right. I think that's probably the most significant one. I'd say if you bump that to 1.25, that's going to open up, you know, quite a bit more demand. So,
yeah. Do you, Steve? Do you imagine that you'll have sellers who thought like, I won't say a detached house because we know that that's not happening probably in that price range. But if it was like a townhouse or a condo and they were going to put it up for 1.15 or whatever, and then they're like, oh, wait, we can get more buyers in the door because there's that 1.25 max. Now, do you think that sellers will want to start raising their prices on homes if this does happen?
I mean, raising their prices is obviously subjective to the market if the market's willing to bear it. But I can tell you strategically from a realtor's pricing perspective, that CMHC cap, that insured mortgage cap, is something that's always factored into the pricing, right? So if I feel this property is on the fringe of, hey, is it $1 million? Is it, you know, $1,050,000? It's always like, hey, let's get it under that 999. Because yeah, I've seen it this year. I've seen it even alone this year where, you know, you list at 999, you get five offers, three of them come in at 999 strictly because they can't go over that number. And then you get the two that obviously don't have to go through the insured program. They push the house up to say $1,050,000 and it gets sold. So again, if you increase that limit to 1.2 or 1.25 or whatever that number is, like, to me, you're basically increasing the number of borrowers that will be willing to spend to that number.
Okay. And this one really kind of jumped out at me. This is the rent to own program. So basically the government wants landlords to charge you below market rates. And then it helps them build up their savings. And then the landlord must commit to ownership in a 5-year term or less. That doesn't seem like a great deal for landlords. I don't know how much of a great deal it is for renters either, but what's your take, John?
I mean, this is, you know, you read policies like these and you start to think that, you know, politicians live in some sort of fantasy land that every condo investor is going to want to charge below market rent just to help this rent to own program. I mean, it's a ridiculous policy. I mean, especially given the fact that they're trying to target individual landlords. I mean, if they want to put money towards a new development, like a rent to own project, I mean, that's different. I don't even think that's a great idea, but certainly targeting small landlords, there's no small landlord that's going to try to get into this rent. I mean, every landlord wants to maximize their profit. They're not motivated by the Liberals' rent-to-own program, I would say.
Okay, and here's another one that I found quite interesting, given the landscape that we see in Vancouver as well as Toronto, is you have young people priced out, but you have multi-generational living, where you know, you have your grandparents, the parents, and then their kids all living under one roof. So what the Liberals are proposing is a tax credit, a 15% tax credit up to $50,000 in renovations. I see that going two ways. One is you expand your home to, you know, for grandparents so that they can stay under the same roof. But I also kind of imagine priced out young people where they're not able to leave the home because they can't afford anything. And the parents have no choice but to build some sort of add-on to the property for their kids to live on. I don't know how this will play out in terms of zoning and stuff, but do you think this is a good idea, Stephen? But also, do you think that this is sort of like almost like throwing in the towel, saying that, yeah, people can't afford, seniors can't afford housing, young people can't afford housing. Let's figure out a way to add an extension to an existing home and give people a tax credit for that.
Yeah, I almost like, I mean, I feel like Vancouver's kind of ahead of the curve because we see a lot of it here where we're seeing a lot of young families sort of partner up, so to speak, with their parents or whatever. And so you get the kids, which, you know, are growing up now and having their own children. And so the grandparents, they are, you know, they're building a laneway house at the back of the property to house the grandparents, so to speak. So yeah, we're seeing more and more, I find, families basically joining forces. Yeah, it's almost going like European style, right? Where, you know, it's pretty common, I think, in like Sweden, you get like 100-year mortgages, and basically the houses essentially just get passed on to the next generation. So it's like you keep the existing asset in the family. And I almost feel like that's kind of like where we're going. And this policy sort of, I suppose, maybe pushes us further in that direction. But it's kind of what it is with the cost of living being so high and people being able to qualify. So yeah, we're seeing more of these almost like generational assets, essentially.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that something like that would play out here, John? I seem to remember it was a heartbreaking story about this dad who made this cool pirate ship pool in their backyard, but the neighbor complained they had to take it down. I just imagine such a mess when it comes to building. In terms of, and there was that mansion I that a family made in Quebec, I believe. And I think it was like just a few inches too close to the curb, but it was already done. It was like $4.9 million. And they had to destroy it and have to start all over again. You know, zoning aside, do you think that this is something that makes sense for the GTA, given high home prices, given seniors struggling to make ends meet, all those things, John?
Yeah, I mean, I think in principle, it's a good idea. But I mean, going back to your point, the question is more importantly, how likely is it for you to be able to do it? And that's the key thing. It's like in the majority of the GTA, you can't build a multi-generational home. Like a multi-generational home isn't a home with a basement apartment. A multi-generational home is like a proper duplex, for example, or a proper triplex. And the reality is in most of the GTA, you can't build that. So this might help people in urban neighborhoods where you can build, you know, duplexes, triplex, where you can build laneway houses. But for 2/3 of the city where you can't build those types of properties, they're not going to really benefit for something like this.
Okay, that's the end of our policy discussion. We don't have to talk about this probably, hopefully, for another 18 months, but we'll see. John, let's get an update on how the market is looking right now and what you expect going into, I guess, fall is the busy time of year typically.
Yeah, I mean, fall it's kind of like the second busiest time after the spring market. And the market's really competitive right here. I mean, for houses, just not a lot of inventory. I'd say the suburbs are quite still hotter than the downtown core. I mean, the downtown's still busy, but not as competitive as the suburbs. Condos are still busy. Everything's just really, it's still a really, really busy market in Toronto. A lot of it is just not a lot of inventory, especially in the low-rise houses.
Do you find, John, that a lot of buyers are settling for the house that's not right for them? It's not going to be their first choice because of that old adage, like beggars can't be choosers. It's just so competitive that a lot of buyers are buying a property that's not really a good fit for them.
100%. And it doesn't matter what price range you're in. I mean, even if your budget's $3 million, you don't really love what you're getting for $3 million. Like you think to yourself, is this all I, you know, and it's true. No matter what price range, everyone's reaction's the same. Like, is this all I'm getting for this? And I do think a lot of people, especially in Toronto, end up kind of settling or coming to terms is probably a better idea or better kind of word for it of what they actually get for their money. Because most people's expectations start high and then they just kind of get beaten up by the market, so to speak, when they see what their dollar buys them.
Steve, what's Vancouver looking like now and heading into the fall?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to Toronto. Obviously, I think these markets tend to move pretty close to each other. You know, I feel like it was a little bit spotty before, you know, pre-election. You know, like entry-level houses obviously is still going crazy, but you know, some stuff above that, you know, where you're like, oh, like surprised that house didn't sell. But you know, condo market's hot. That seems to be gaining momentum. We're seeing a lot of strength in the one-bedroom condos downtown, so that market's, you know, definitely changed since the onset of the pandemic. Yeah, overall just a market that continues to be plagued by just a lack of new listings coming to market. So the inventory is still extremely tight. I think that's continues to be sort of the headline story here is that, you know, demand is strong. It's certainly not what it was back in March or April, but the demand is still very strong. And the number of listings coming to market just remains extremely low. So overall a tight and competitive market pretty much across all the segments.
All right. We'll see if that ever changes in my career watching Canadian real estate. But I mean, obviously, we've had corrections along the way. I'm careful to point that out. But anyways, that brings us to the end of yet another show and another show where we were unable, unfortunately, to get to your questions. I promise we will get to those next time around. But I mean, there's a lot to talk about in this platform. We have a new government and there's a lot of possible changes coming your way, home buyers and home sellers. But in the meantime, until our next show, please do check Yahoo Finance Canada for all your latest in real estate news, stock market. We have constant live updates, retail, energy, cryptocurrencies, you name it. See you next time.